Welcome to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu, back with another edition of On DoD. Glad you're with us. This week, we'll spend most of the show focused on two topics, the looming cuts to the defense budget under sequestration and the complexion of the Defense Department in a second term under President Barack Obama. We've obviously covered sequestration extensively on this station for more than a year, but we're getting down to the wire now. Congress has a little more than a month to find an alternative deficit reduction plan before more than $1 trillion in new spending cuts kick in, half of them hitting DOD directly. We talked to several leading defense experts here in Washington about what's ahead for DOD. We begin with Todd Harrison. He's the Senior Fellow for Defense Budget Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. And when it comes to a second Obama term and its impact on DOD, he says it's hard to see past January 2nd right now.
Well, of course, the big unknown right now is what's going to happen with sequestration. And that actually has very little to do with defense. It's really about whether or not Congress and the White House can finally reach some sort of compromise to avoid sequestration, and that depends on their ability to find an agreement on taxes and entitlement programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Depending on what kind of compromise they can reach there, we may be able to avoid sequestration. But even if we avoid it, there may be some additional cuts to defense as part of that compromise agreement, not on the order of 10% like sequestration could do, but perhaps less, 5% or 3%. So that is really the big unknown right now. And, you know, we just, you know, this fog bank of sequestration just really is preventing us from seeing much past January 2nd.
Yeah, because, I mean, as you say, that's going to involve a deficit reduction deal of some kind. It's hard to imagine that defense is held completely harmless in that deal, isn't it?
Right. It is likely that we'll see additional cuts in defense spending over the next decade. If anything, just because you look back at the history, and the defense budget has gone through, three full cycles of up and down since the end of World War II. It looks like we're coming off one of the peaks in those cycles. And if historical trends hold true at all, we could be looking at a 20 or 30% gradual reduction in defense spending over the next decade. And given the fact that, you know, we have near record federal deficit right now, it seems, you know, reasonable to assume that defense is going to be part of that deficit reduction effort.
And is it possible to speculate sort of what the character of those reductions would be, whether they're in procurement, vice O&M, vice somewhere else, or just kind of even across the board?
Well, that's where DOD faces a number of really hard choices in the coming years. Even if they manage to maintain a flat budget, they've got a number of things within their budget going on that are going to make it difficult to manage. The first of which is personnel cost. Right now, military personnel costs consume almost a third of the defense budget. Those costs have grown dramatically over the past decade. The cost per person in the military has gone up by about 46% in real terms over the past decade. That kind of growth can't continue into the future, or it will simply crowd out all other investments within the budget. So what are they going to do to slow the growth of military personnel costs? That's a tough issue to tackle. Another issue is the cost of operations and maintenance, and much of that goes to fund readiness. Keeping our troops, at the top of their training, keeping our equipment, fully maintained and ready to go. That's expensive. That consumes about a fifth of the overall defense budget, the base defense budget. Those costs have historically increased at about 2 to 3% a year above the rate of inflation. And again, if those costs continue increasing over the next decade, they will start to crowd out other areas of the budget. So the department's got to make a decision about what they want to do in terms of readiness. If you want to preserve readiness but keep costs down, that means you have to reduce force structure. You'll get smaller. Or you could maintain force structure and make a conscious decision to reduce readiness, perhaps going to a tiered readiness system as has been tried in the past. There's not an easy answer there. Getting smaller or getting less ready, neither is a good choice to have to make. But in a constrained funding environment, that's what the department's going to have to do.
And as far as leadership changes, you know, I guess Secretary Panetta is widely rumored to be expected to leave sometime soon. I don't know how much you want to get into that particular Washington parlor game of speculating who's next. But I guess my question really is, how much difference does a defense secretary make in managing a bill down like this?
I think, you know, the next Secretary of Defense really will have an opportunity to put, you know, his or her thumbprint on the future of the department. Because there are a number of major decisions that are going to have to be made, and a lot of those decisions are going to stop at the Secretary's desk. In terms of, you know, following through on this pivot to the Asia-Pacific region, what does that really mean? What kind of new capabilities are we going to invest in or not invest in over the next decade? You know, the decision on a lot of those things is going to be made in the next few years. You know, in terms of managing the drawdown from Afghanistan, the already planned reduction of about 100,000 troops in our ground forces, and, you know, decision of whether or not, you know, we need to, you know, draw down even more and take our ground forces down to an even smaller size than they were before 9/11. You know, the next Secretary of Defense is going to have a lot of room to influence those major decisions.
Obviously, as we said before, a lot of this hinges on what happens with the sequestration deal, assuming there is a deal. But with a second Obama term, would you expect strategy and planning and budgets and programs to differ very dramatically from what we've already seen in the, you know, 13-17 POM that they laid out along with the new defense strategy? Or are we basically probably going to track pretty closely to what they laid out last year?
I think they're going to try to track closely to what they laid out. Over this past budget year, we're going to see a lot of continuity, as one would expect when the administration has not changed. We will have to see some tweaks to that strategy, though, if the budget is reduced, if not from sequestration, from some other, you know, deficit reduction deal, because they made it pretty clear that the strategy, the strategic guidance they put forth last year was tied to the budget, and if they didn't get that full budget, they would not be able to execute that strategy. And I think that is true looking at it. It's questionable that they would have been able to execute it with the budget that if they had gotten the budget they submitted. So any reduction in the funding, they're going to have to go back and look at their strategy again. And I wouldn't expect major changes, but I would expect some tweaking as the years go by.
I wanted to ask you about civilian personnel because that's a big part of our audience. And in your really great analysis of the sequester a few months ago, you pointed out that they would take a disproportionate hit because of the cuts in O&M funding. General Odierno at CSIS indicated that they're probably, even without sequester, if I understood correctly, going to come down at a pace that's, you know, disproportionate to the rest of the funding cuts as the uniformed services come back. Is that your read on what happens across DOD? Civilian personnel probably get cut back and uniformed personnel maybe fill some of those billets as they come out of the war zones?
Yeah, I think it's true that DOD civilian workforce is going to have to get smaller in the coming years. Not only has the Army and Marine Corps reduced their numbers of, you know, active duty service members, you know, we'll see at least a proportionate reduction in DOD civilians that go along with that reduction. But any future reductions in the defense budget, you know, you're going to have to start drawing down the size of the DOD civilian workforce. Right now, DOD employs about 791,000 full-time equivalents in the civilian workforce. Under sequestration, we would see, you know, furloughs really starting fairly quickly, I think, within the first few weeks or months after sequestration goes into effect. That could affect, you know, over 100,000 you know, full-time equivalents within the civilian workforce. Now, if they spread those furloughs out broadly, it could end up affecting nearly everyone, you know, being asked to take a few weeks of unpaid vacation, if you will. You can call that a vacation. But, yeah, I think the civilian workforce, it's going to be lean times for the next few years. It's probably not going to be pleasant. There are going to be some, you know, major reductions one way or the other. And, you know, as part of the overall federal workforce, DOD civilians have not gotten a pay raise in the past several years. And that may continue into the future as part of a broader effort to reduce federal government spending.
And finally, I wanted to ask about military personnel costs, as you alluded to before. DOD's asked Congress for permission to get after that in some ways. Do you think this this ultimate deficit deal might be the forcing function that eventually pushes Congress to assent to at least some of those requests to cut personnel costs?
It's not clear if that'll do it. I think there's a lot of entrenched opposition, in some cases for good reasons, to cutting military pay and benefits, especially in a time when we have a number of young veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. The nation, feels a debt of, gratitude to these folks. And the idea of cutting back their pay and benefits has not proven very popular in Congress. But the fact of the matter is that military personnel costs are growing fast, and they are driving part of the defense budget. I think perhaps what the deficit reduction deal might force is Congress to agree to some sort of an independent commission, kind of like the base closure commissions, a BRAC process that Congress has used in the past for closing bases. They might agree to create some sort of commission like that to look at military pay and benefits, including health care and retirement, and have that commission come back with an independent recommendation of, kind of a comprehensive change to the system, one that reduces costs, but also is something that potentially is preferred by more service members at all different rank levels. I think that's possible, I think that's something that, this kind of fiscal pressure might push the department to actually do.
Todd Harrison is the Senior Fellow for Defense Budget Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. Todd, thanks as always for talking with us.
All right, no problem.
When we come back, we will continue our conversations on the defense budget and sequestration. Our next voice, Tom Donnelly from the American Enterprise Institute. As you'll hear, he thinks sequestration is something of a best-case scenario for DOD. This is on DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servio. Welcome back to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servu. Fresh off of a presidential election and with just over a month to go for Congress to come up with an alternative debt reduction scenario to replace the cuts that are set to happen across government under sequestration, we figured we'd spend most of this hour talking about sequestration and the next 4 years under the next Obama administration for DOD. We heard in the last segment from Todd Harrison from the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. In this segment, Tom Donnelly. He is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and co-director of the Marilyn Ware Center for Security Studies at AEI. He told me that the funding levels DOD would receive under sequestration ought to be thought of as something as a best-case scenario. He thinks more cuts are coming, or as he puts it, sequestration going forward will be a ceiling for defense spending, not a floor.
I say that because of the politics of the situation, in that over the past year, we've pretty clearly seen that for neither party is the defense budget a top priority. And so both, that was the deal essentially reflected in the Budget Control Act and in the sequestration provision. So if the parties, what I would really be afraid of is that the Republican leadership in the House and the White House would work out some either a short-term or longer-term budget deal that would essentially lock in the cuts reflected both in the BCA and in sequestration to minimize the sacrifices made on tax revenues and on entitlements.
Presumably, though, it would not get triggered at the full 10% in 1 year, though, under whatever deal occurs. Though, right?
I think it might do, actually. Look, by the time this gets resolved, sequestration has essentially been in effect, and the department you know, would at least have clarity and it could make trade-offs. So the actual budgetary impacts are already being felt and thus are sort of weirdly mitigated or sort of already factored into department planning. And the second thing that will be, I think, I'm sure, reflected in the 14 budget, but is essentially also being reflected in department planning, is the president's defense guidance, basically reducing the standard of sufficiency to the one war construct, just to use the shorthand term, that's reflected in the guidance. And so they'll be able to say that lower standard allows further cuts to be made. If all we're going to do is fight one war that lasts just 21 days and so on and so forth, then we're not going to get involved in any extended counterinsurgency or peacekeeping or irregular war type operations, we can actually, or so the argument will go, stand to cut some more.
The department, I think, has been pretty clear that they don't believe that the strategy as they laid it out in January is executable under the funding levels contemplated under sequestration. Are they right about that?
I think they'll repeat what their commander-in-chief decides. I've been doing this long enough that and seen the risk factor or the risk-o-meter, if you will, essentially be manipulated in order to support whatever the budget is. Again, I expect they will say, oh, it's really, really hard. Please don't cut anymore. We're on a razor's edge, so on and so forth. But we can just barely, maybe we can just barely make it if all we're asked to do is, you know, one short war and a few anti-piracy operations. It would also require that members of Congress and Republican members of Congress be willing to hold the chiefs to account. And for, you know, the Republican opposition, the House-led Republican opposition, if the cost of meeting the strategy involves tax increases, again, I think their track record very much is that they're willing to look the other way.
So let's play this out over the next few years. If the scenario that you're imagining comes to pass, what does the national defense picture look like over, let's say, the next FYDP?
Well, I can see Army end strength going down into the low 400,000s, active duty end strength. I can see modernization programs, particularly the F-35, but not just that. Being slowed down even farther. I could imagine that the carrier version of the F-35, the C version, might be terminated entirely. Whether we could afford to buy tankers on schedule would be an open question. We've already, after a decade or more of trying to buy two attack submarines a year, already bumped one of those out of the FYDP. I could see us going back to a one boat per year rate. We have nuclear modernization that will be required, Trident missile and eventually a submarine replacement. I can see an arms control deal that is negotiated that magically obviates the need or the pressing need for nuclear modernization. We've been waiting for a couple of decades to buy a new bomber, so on and so forth. Our presence missions, there's not much left to cut out of Europe, but we could be down to essentially just headquarters elements and, not even a single maneuver brigade, but you know, rotational units that go there. So the ways that we've been slicing the salami in the past, we could just keep doing.
And just to be clear, I want to make sure that I understand whether or not you're saying that all of this is a consequence directly of this election. Had it gone the other way, you know, was Mr. Romney's pledge to take us up to 4% of GDP realistic, or would the same politics that you're talking about be in place with him as president?
No, I think the politics would be different. First of all, the governor said it. You know, when we would actually get to 4% of base GDP would have been an interesting question. And I think the campaign certainly was serious, and the transition effort had already been tasked with finding ways to make it so. And the politics of the debt and deficit would have been resolved in a very different way. The fundamental underlying problem would still be there. And the real problem is that mandatory spending and entitlement spending are basically squeezing everything else out, not just defense, but domestic discretionary. So the pressures would have been there, but I think the political backdrop would have been not entirely different, but substantially different.
So if you had to gamble on what happens between now and January, does sequestration kind of in its current form just take effect, or does some kind of alternative but still bad scenario get
there? There might be a deal that, you know, sort of like the one proposed by Senator Levin, wherein the automaticity, if that's the right word, of the cuts, you know, the department gets to decide or has more control about where the cuts are taken. But getting on that sort of slope towards the funding levels that reflect sequestration seemed to me to be a pretty more likely than not outcome.
Wanted to ask you, too, about the prospect of senior leadership changes. You know, it seems like it's been pretty stable so far, kind of like the rest of the administration, and, you know, a lot of speculation about Panetta departing soon. Would you expect to start seeing some of the service secretaries, for example, leave and be replaced?
Oh, absolutely. Although on the service secretary level, you know, they could languish and be vacant for a while. Like Secretary Clinton said she's leaving. Attorney General Holder hinted as much. Panetta was kind of a caretaker guy anyway. So, yeah, I'm sure there'll be. And there are a lot of people sort of at the deputy and under level, you know, who have been there for 4 years and are just exhausted.
Tom Donnelly is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and co-director of the Maryland Ware Center for Security Studies at AEI. Stay with us. We will hear more expert views on what's ahead for the Defense Department over the next months and years and the looming threat of sequestration for the DoD budget after a short break. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. We're back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. This is On DoD. Glad you're with us. We'll spend one more segment talking about sequestration as the clock ticks down on Congress. Just a little over a month to go now until those automatic cuts kick in. Congress has not much time to find an alternative approach. In this segment, as we explore the possible alternatives to those cuts and what's ahead in the next 4 years under a second Obama term, we'll talk to Russell Rumbaugh. He's a senior associate at the Stimson Center and director of Stimson's Budgeting for Foreign Affairs and Defense Program. He told me the trickiest part about predicting the future when it comes to defense spending over the next 4 years and the defense drawdown is what exactly will happen to the overseas contingency operations accounts, the money the DoD used to fund the Iraq War and now the war in Afghanistan.
The most important thing to realize is, although defense is an incredibly important part of the sequestration conversation, it's not about the level of defense. Between the House and Senate appropriators, if we include war costs, they're less than $1 billion apart. In a $500 billion base budget and a greater than $600 billion war budget, in base and war budget, $1 billion is a very, very small amount. That's very mild policy change in between. So really, the two chambers, and by proxy the two parties, have already agreed on what the defense number could be for FY13. Defense's most important role in this lame duck sequestration debate, or more importantly in the lame duck fiscal cliff debate, is as the forcing function to drive a decision, to drive an agreement about how to handle the fiscal cliff.
Aren't both of those, I may be wrong about this, but aren't both of those appropriations bills already outside the BCA caps?
The Senate is not outside the BCA cap. The Senate matches the BCA caps. The House is outside of the BCA caps, so they're looking for some kind of change anyway. Of course, the main way the Senate makes the BCA caps and the House doesn't is it's moved some funding out of the base into the war budget, which doesn't count against the BCA caps.
Okay, subject to sequester, but not subject to the BCA cap. Is that am I understanding?
Correct.
Right?
So we have to remember there's two kinds of sequester. There's
right.
sort of what I would like to call the traditional sequester. If you exceed the discretionary caps on what the agreement says you can spend, however amount you exceed it by will be sequestered. That's traditionally how sequester has worked. The sequester we're talking about come January 2nd is the enforcement sequester. Because the supercommittee failed to come up with an agreement, the required deficit reduction would be achieved automatically through this sequestration mechanism. They're really different mechanisms between the traditional sequester and the enforcement sequester.
Right. So in your view, do they get to a deal that keeps us basically along the lines of just the 487 that they've already taken in the BCA, or do we go higher than that in whatever deal comes about?
I don't see a big appetite for large defense cuts. Do I think large defense cuts could be done as part of a grand bargain? Yes, I do. However, the grand bargain itself seems like a very difficult reach. The most important point to remember here is that although entitlements are a part of our fiscal crisis, they're not a part of the fiscal cliff. Discretionary spending, because of sequester, is at risk and is pertinent for January 2nd. Revenue, because of the expiration of the Bush-era tax cuts at the same time, is part of the fiscal cliff. But entitlements, for the most part, aren't. There's some that are captured in the sequester provision, but not the big entitlements, not the ones that are driving the larger fiscal crisis we face.
Okay. So how much does the next 4 years and what defense spending and defense strategy looks like depend on what happens between now and January? Do you think this is basically a done deal and we know where DOD is headed?
The biggest point about deciding what happens in the next 4 years is what happens with war costs. If they continue to go down, we've seen a very significant drop, $160 billion to $115 billion to a request this year of $88.5 billion. That's two really large drops. If it continues that way and war costs just go away, which is the assumption, we're out of Iraq, we're supposed to get out of Afghanistan, supposedly war costs just go away, that's been the biggest driver already. That's already a change of a little less than a fifth.
And broadly, does that leave us with the strategic guidance that came out in January, basically continuing to be the framework for how DOD spends and prioritizes in the second term?
To get to levels like to get to the sequester levels, which if you smoothed it out, if you didn't take it in the first year, but smoothed it out, would look an awful lot like previous defense downturn. So it isn't unreasonable to think may happen, but to get that in an agreement up front, I think needs to be rolled up in a broader bargain, this grand bargain. Some have postulated that although the grand bargain may not be reached this lame duck, and if a new enforcement regime could be enacted that forces the grand bargain later. Obviously, we've seen how well those things work in the past. And so that may not be the most likely outcome. And of course, there's a possibility we have a grand bargain this way. In that sense, if we got that, I think you would see a fundamentally different look at defense spending in the next 4 years. But right now, it looks like we can expect defense spending to be at roughly this level, although I'll expect that every year it will be drawn down just a little bit more. Once the big change has been made, the Congress, that both the President and the Congress can and tweak it down just a little bit to try to free up some resources elsewhere. So I won't be surprised to see continuing downward pressure on defense, although, again, just downward pressure, not a fundamentally different level.
So not, you know, not on the level that we've seen in other post-war drawdowns, in other words.
Well, of course, we can't tell, right? If you include war costs and war costs go away, the level will look, the decrease will look very much the same, something around 30%. The problem is, because of war costs, we're starting this time at a much higher level than we have in the past. Even compared to the Korean War peak, we're starting at a much higher level. So if you take that 30%, even if you take that 30%, you're at a much higher level than we have previously reached in the troughs, in the nadirs of defense spending. There was one post-Korean War, one post-Vietnam, and one post-Cold War. These nadirs are incredibly stable. They're just shy of $400 billion in today's term. We would still be well above $500 billion. That's a big swing still. We're not getting a lot of historical value in looking at it. We're not getting a lot of historical insight into what it'll look like in the future. I think that's the biggest question going on. Are we going to see the drop down be what stays the same, or are we going to see the nadir what stays the same? Those are the two biggest questions happening here, I think.
We're talking with Russell Rumbaugh, the senior associate at the Stimson Center and director of Stimson's Budgeting for Foreign Affairs and Defense Program, one of several DOD budget experts we're hearing from on this week's edition of On DOD. We'll return for one more segment on sequestration and the DOD budget in the coming years. This is On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, I'm Jared Serbu. Welcome back to On DOD. We're spending the hour on sequestration and the defense budget in a second Obama term as Congress gets down to the wire on the deadline to find an alternative to the roughly $500 billion in automatic across-the-board spending cuts DOD would have imposed upon it if sequestration were to occur. We'll close out the show this week by finishing our conversation with Russell Rumbaugh. He's a senior associate at the Stimson Center, director of its Budgeting for Foreign Affairs and Defense Program, and a former defense analyst for the Senate Budget Committee. This is slightly off topic, but I wanted to ask you about the effect of operating under a CR, at least for another few months. How hard is that to do for the department? Can they mostly mitigate it through reprogrammings, or is it another kind of albatross as far as management around their neck?
It's certainly not the most effective and efficient way to manage the Department of Defense, although, again, I think we need to put this in context, right? We're having a debate about the very nature of the future of the country. It's probably okay that we're not most efficiently spending the Defense Department money. Certainly, CRs always make things a little bit more difficult. There's the inherent uncertainty of, well, what's the final answer going to be? There is the unique restrictions put on by a CR. There is not as much freedom. There are outlets, things like reprogramming. The department can come back, but nevertheless, it is more constraining to pretend that otherwise would do a disservice.
If there are cuts beyond the 487, even if they are somewhat modest, is it clear exactly what the complexion of those would be? Would they be kind of across the board? Would they be concentrated, do you think, in O&M or procurement? Any way to know at this point?
It's a great question. You can answer it a lot of different ways. Procurement traditionally pays the first and most, and we're already seeing that. Now, what is frequently left out of that conversation is procurement benefits the first and most when the defense budget starts going up again. The procurement, just like the entire defense budget, cycles up and down, but procurement does it in steeper ways with higher peaks and lower valleys. We've already seen that go on, and that is likely to continue for a couple more years. In the post-Cold War drawdown, or the Reagan drawdown, which started really in 1986, it's not until 1995 that you get the lowest procurement numbers. So that's a long downturn. O&M is an interesting has a very interesting dynamics. O&M does have some to give, especially as you pull down force structure, there's just less to be spent on. But O&M has a long-term trend going up over time. And in the 90s, it seemed that we found an O&M floor to maintain and to run our force as we wanted to, which is at a very high level of training. It's one of the great things about the American military. There is a floor to how much O&M you can cut to. And it appears that we found that in the 90s. O&M was cut pretty sharply to begin with, and then stopped getting cut, went up a little bit, and evened out. That probably tells us that O&M is going to settle out. Personnel is really difficult. The Air Force and the Navy are smaller in personnel terms than they were in 2000. Not post-Cold War, pre-9/11. That's a big deal. That means they don't have a lot of personnel costs to give. In past downturns, personnel costs have been one of the biggest payers. The Army and Marine Corps, which did increase over the last decade or so, actually have already given up their personnel savings because the president's budget says all of the personnel above my final goal number are really only there because they're fighting the wars. Those costs were moved into the war budget. That's great. There's a perfectly fine rationale there. But what it means is all the savings from the decreasing the end strengths of the Army and Marines have already been taken.
Mm.
So that is a big change from past drawdowns we've seen. Of here we are, less than 3 years into the drawdown, and the personnel savings have already been taken. Unless we're going to start talking about somewhat fairly fundamental restructuring of what our military forces look like.
Well, and one big component of those personnel costs is, of course, healthcare, which seems to grow sort of irrespective of the size of the force. You know, DOD's made modest requests to try and rein those in. Congress has so far said no. Do you see that changing as we go into this grand bargain period? Might that be a forcing function to get them to get Congress to assent to at least some of those requests along the healthcare lines?
Healthcare is actually in both personnel and in O&M as well, actually. It's part of the big driver of
right.
the O&M costs. Healthcare is absolutely a huge feature within the Department of Defense, just as it is for the country at large. And yes, the department has proposed specific fixes that would help. Congress actually did take a step last year. They did allow indexing of premiums, so it's at least not getting as bad as it was just 2 years ago. But this round, all of the bills have rejected the proposals the Pentagon put in. What looks particularly different this time is we're starting to hear more and more from the uniformed military that, hey, we do need to be careful and we do need to make some choices. We have to be aware of the burden of these personnel costs and how long that burden remains with us. That's different than we've heard in the past. What started this this defense buildup back in the late 90s, the first big mover was the repeal of Redux. Redux was the reform of the military retirement system way back in the 1980s. It is the repeal of that before anybody actually got caught by Redux that the Joint Chiefs did publicly support, and that was the first driver of the increased defense budgets that we just recently ended. Having the chief say something different is a different dynamic, and it'll be interesting to how persuasive that is to Congress.
Mm. I guess finally, I know you're a budget guy, but I wanted to ask you about leadership changes since there's so much speculation around that right now, mostly around along the lines of how much it matters who the defense secretary is when you talk about these issues, or even the service secretaries. If we do see a new slate of civilian leaders in DOD, is it going to have a big impact over where we're headed over the next few years?
I think it depends on how you ask the question. Where are we headed? Who gets selected for defense secretary is not going to change the fundamental slant of the defense budget. At the same time, the way our system works, the Secretary of Defense is a very powerful person, but it takes a great deal of effort and political capital to effectively use their power. That means there's only a handful of issues that they personally can change the direction of. Sometimes those handful of issues are teed up by the external circumstances or the forces the building is facing, but obviously the personality of the secretary matters, and the choices they make matter and which ones they pursue. So absolutely it matters who comes in, but again, at a level down, the general trend of where our military is headed is set. And of course, that's largely because Congress is a partner in those decisions.
Russell Rumbaugh is a senior associate at the Stimson Center. He's also director of Stimson's Budgeting for Foreign Affairs and Defense Program, one of several experts we heard from today on this week's edition of On DoD as we look ahead to possible alternatives to sequestration as Congress works down to the wire in these final few weeks before those automatic spending cuts are set to kick in on January 2nd. That's going to do it for this week's show. Glad you could join us. Tune in next week for another edition of On DoD here on Federal News Radio. I'm Jared Serbin. Thanks for listening. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.